From the neon lights of the club to the harsh buzzing lights of the office, don't let the wear show on your face. Just swipe Maybelline Instant Eraser Concealer to erase the night before, wherever that happens to be. Instantly cover dark circles and under eye bags for a brighter, more awake look. This do-it-all formula also contours, corrects, and highlights, all while staying lightweight, crease-resistant, and smooth. It may be the world's greatest eraser. Find your shade of Instant Eraser Concealer at your local retailer.
What's up, Oos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I started my first business when I was 12, mowing lawns for about $5 a yard. I learned if you do the job right, people trust you and customers care that you show up and do what you say you're going to do. Hi, I'm Tommy Mello, owner of Don's Garage Doors. From garage door repairs to upgrades, we show up, we stand behind every job. We only use the best parts and springs guaranteed to last a lifetime. When you care about the people you serve, you work harder and it shows. Call Don's Garage Doors today or schedule online at donsgaragedoors.com.
When it comes to garage doors, no one knows more.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Just because they seem normal doesn't mean they are. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Nancy Guthrie has been missing for over 3 months. No arrests. Remember, 5 months now, really. The FBI director also publicly questioning how the investigation was handled. We'll let that live with its grain of salt that it is. The family has been cleared and still attacked online. The media outlets gave a platform to hoax ransom demands that may have done more harm than good. And here we sit, still with no answers. This morning, joining me, as always, Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, my co-host, and Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor. Eric, let's dive here into the world of Nancy Guthrie. And I think something a lot of people are still sitting with and a lot of people are still shaking their heads on, the Guthrie family has been cleared. You know, obviously, people are entitled to their own opinions and things of that nature, but there's still a lot of people out there fabricating claims, implying motive, naming names, literally just making up stories and shit, and it's just flowing throughout the internets as the internets do. Nobody's been sued yet from the Guthrie family, but what would it actually take for the Guthries to start suing some of the people that are naming them as the perpetrators of Nancy's death, and when? And I guess, why haven't they yet?
Sure. So, Tony, they could start with a defamation claim. That's yeah. where someone makes a false statement of fact about you, and you suffer damages because of that. Now, those can be tricky because you can't bring such a claim based on somebody's opinion. If the statement was put forth in the form of an opinion, then perhaps it's not a statement of fact. Perhaps defamation does not apply. On top of that, they would have to prove some kind of reputational harm, which they'd probably be able to do that to some extent. The last factor, Tony, is collectability. Even if you find some Yahoo on the internet who's spouting off bullshit about you, do they have any assets to actually pay you? And if you bring a claim, you've got to pay your own attorney. It's going to be costly for you. So a lot of hurdles for this family to try to defend themselves against some of these false statements.
You know, we've had so many of these new claims, and because of all the platforms out there attacking family, attacking everything left, right, and sideways, because it's good clickbait for everyone. Eric, have you seen a shift in defamation claims over the last couple of years because of these types of things? And I know that monetary factor is a really challenging one to reach. Has anyone actually sued successfully or even tried to just for retractions in any of these areas?
I haven't seen a ton of traction on that front. You would think because there, you know, there might be more publicly available false statements in the ether and in the internet, that would lead to an increase in defamation claims. Not something I've personally seen. You know, my understanding is that some of the law enforcement folks in the Karen Reed case wanted to go after Turtle Boy and some of the other individuals who were allegedly making false statements about them. I haven't really heard of any developments on that front. Even though there's been more potentially false statements in the public, there have not been more defamation claims based on those false statements that I've seen.
What kind of world are we living in for defamation? Because it feels like anybody can say anything these days and fairly get away with it. I mean, Turtle Boy is a good example, and I'm not trying to get on the Karen Reed case, but just, I mean, really vile shit that's been said about people with not a lot of grounding. And I'm not here to litigate Karen Reed, but I'm just using that as an example of very extreme speech. And we've seen it here in the Nancy Guthrie case, too, where there's been accusations against some of the family members here and people going down rabbit holes saying, see, because of this, because are we in a world where this is just kind of the new norm? This is the regular level for the pool now. It used to be down here, now it's up here. It's getting, you know, it's invading areas that we used to feel comfortable in, and it just is. The water level has risen and there's nothing you can do about it. Or are we in a place where, because there's more people saying things that are really, you know, factually out of line and can be defaming and liable, is it one of those things where there's too much of it to even go after anymore, especially in a high profile case like this? Because if you go after one of them, it's like whack-a-mole. They're just going to keep popping up. And if you knock down one, does that really stop other ones? If you were an attorney and somebody came to you and said, hey, if they came to you and said, hey, what would you advise them? Does it make sense to sue when people are saying crazy shit these days? Because it seems you got one and you got 50 more.
Yeah, Tony, you know, the law can be very reactive. We have these changing social times and social practices and social norms, and it sometimes takes the law a while to catch up, sometimes years or decades.
Yeah.
So we have an increase, right, in potentially defamatory statements due to the internet. But we don't necessarily have an increase in available remedies on the legal side. You know, if someone came to me, it wouldn't be unreasonable for that person to try to send a demand letter to the person issuing the defamatory statements. Say, hey, you've got to stop this. You've got to issue a retraction or else we're going to sue you. But is that a bluff? Is that like an empty threat? Because can you really follow through on that? If you sue them and there's no money available, then really what it is the defamation victim going out of pocket thousands and thousands of dollars, yeah, not getting any sort of outcome that they're looking for. And now they're worse off.
Yeah, well, it doesn't seem. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Katani, go ahead.
I'm just gonna say, and at the same point, does it just open up the door for more fodder and more speculation and more people to dig in? Because if it actually goes through and it's not just settled, you got depositions, you got more things that could come out. I mean, yes, I mean, it could be sealed, but does it create more? And if you're the person that's being defamed, is it something where you just kind of got to look at it as, just let it settle. It will settle faster by doing nothing, by letting the madness do what the madness does, versus you going out there with the spoon and stirring it up really bad. And, you know, maybe it makes you feel good, especially if collectability and money is not your motive. It's just shut up. Just stop saying crazy shit. If that's really the goal, does going after this, especially in something like this, where it's thousands of people, it's not just like one-on-one with a defamation suit, it's whack-a-mole. Does it make sense to go after it that way? If your ultimate goal is just to get people to shut up because they're harming you by your reputation, by saying false things.
You know, my fear, Tony, is that it could actually make it worse. Creative Chaosify in the comments mentioned, in order to win a defamation case, you got to prove the statement is false and that it's a statement of fact. And when you get into discovery, you know, those folks might say, well, based on X, Y, and Z, I really do think the family member did something wrong or whatever. And does that highlight, does that bring a magnifying glass then to this allegedly defamatory statement? And then if you don't prevail on the defamation claim, is that some sort of implicit message that in fact, the family did engage in some kind of wrongdoing? I think it's just such a can of worms without a great legal solution. Yeah. And so it might be best to just, like, you know, let them chat it up and be idiots and go about your life. I don't know the law has a great legal mechanism to solve this problem presently.
Yeah,
it's a big challenge, because even when we're talking about these other cases with parents involved and trying to rein in children from doing horrendous things that we're seeing, it's guardrails. And typically, we're used to the law being able to provide guardrails for behavior. That's what keeps society functioning. We have trust in our institutions and everything like that. And yet, we don't seem to have a guardrail because of free speech. At the same time, when does free speech get too outlandish? And to one of the comments I saw just a few minutes ago, you know, it's spaces like ours where you can have free speech and you can do things, but I think there's a difference in how would you capture this legally then, or could you? You know, we people typically that are trying to do opinion pieces like we do, we throw caveats before them, like, you know, innocent till proven guilty, but let's do a thought experiment. You know, I'm using some conjecture here. So in other words, when you can caveat, you know, a thought experiment, you know, bracket it with language that says it's just that, you know, I think that can be a safer space for that free speech. Is there any way you can rein people in that are just saying, because I mean, we've seen things with the Guthrie family where they say, we have an insider source saying that the son-in-law is a prime suspect. I mean, that's not like, hey, it's my opinion, let's do a thought experiment, or the conjecture on this is this. It was a boom, boom, boom. I mean, there's a big difference in my mind.
Right. You know, a lot of subtlety and nuance is completely lost on internet commentary. You know, one solution, Robin, that some legal theorists have suggested is that some of these platforms, perhaps they should be held responsible to some degree if they are hosting defamatory statements and not doing anything to rein them in. You know, that's why during COVID and stuff, they implemented some fact checkers, and that, you know, had mixed results, I think.
Sideways.
and so some people are saying, hey, if you hold the platforms like Meta, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube liable for what their users are posting, it might clamp down on that. However, that could also have a chilling effect on free speech, and you're in for a years-long legal fight against these Goliaths. And so, again, not a bunch of great outs on that front either.
Yeah, I think they try to do that. Like YouTube, I know, tries to do that with their bots. And it's just a giant mess. It ends up tampering valuable speech and valuable information because it prioritizes people's emotions over context and fact. It doesn't make you feel yucky, rather than are you getting something that may make you feel yucky. And I'm speaking like a child, because that's really kind of how I feel like these platforms handle it. Like we're all in kindergarten, the way that they try to shield people from things based on what's going to make them feel icky versus what, it may make you feel bad, but it's information you need for context for this case or this situation, because it's part of the damn case. But I don't know. I don't know what the answer is either. I mean, is there a way to police that accurately? We're certainly not there yet. We know that much. The FBI director, Cash Mo Money Patel, Mo Money Mo Problems, I guess, has the first thing I've seen from him that I'm like, it's an interesting statement and probably fairly true. Said his agency was locked out of the case for days, and questioned how evidence was handled. Interesting. Speaking up, basically a kind of passive-aggressive way, speaking against the sheriff. The crime scene was released early. A sergeant with no homicide experience was put in charge. If the Guthrie family wanted to bring a civil action against the county for how the investigation was run, number one, can they? And I mean, what is the legal threshold to prove that incompetence costs them their mother? And I guess how high is that bar? If you have the FBI director saying, this should have been thrown over to us quicker. I mean, you have errors and things. People always look back and want to do things better. But when it really is just this discombobulated chaos train that it feels like it's been from day one, if you can prove that legally, is there a legal threshold here that exists for going after the local investigation for poor handling?
The legal options on that are extraordinarily slim. So yeah. Look, let's say we're talking about the private sector hypothetical. Let's say a business mm-hmm. hires an accounting company to do their books or something. And the accounting company is totally negligent. They deviate from standards. They screw it up. They lead to bad outcomes for this business. The business could sue them and say this accounting company was negligent, that cost us this money. We have these losses. We need to recoup these. That there is not a corollary that exists with respect to law enforcement negligently handling investigation. They have what's called qualified immunity, whereby it's basically, unless you screw up terribly bad, you are not, the claimant cannot bring a claim against government officials for that. Now, if there was intentional conduct that was like a sabotage of the investigation, that might squeak through. If there was gross negligence, so a gross deviation of the standard of care, it's possible, but I think it's extraordinarily unlikely with qualified immunity as it exists presently. And many legal scholars have advocated for reforming qualified mm-hmm. immunity so that folks can be held accountable if they're in the public sector in the same way that they might be held accountable in the private sector.
And just think of how challenging it is, because we know the investigation in the Karen Reed case was horrendous. And besides that, Delphi, Richard Allen would be going through a new trial right now if that was the case, because of the gross negligence of all the investigators part of both those cases. So
yeah, I'm curious.
It's a hard leap.
Eric, you know, from an attorney perspective, I mean, what's your opinion on that? Is that a good idea? Should the bar be lowered for being able to go after authority figures, depending on what they are and what they do, where it's not such a mountain to climb? Because it seems so many damn cases, more times than not, that seems to be the consistent line that goes through all of them, is a lot of incompetence. Now, it's shady, or it gets to be kind of a gray area, I should say, where, okay, what is just, you know, human error, and then what is gross incompetence? Because for one department, what looks like gross incompetence could just be their level of IQ to begin with. They might just be a bunch of idiots to begin with. It's just a department of Nimrods and they make horrible decisions, but that's what you get. And in another case, it could be very intelligent, well-meaning people, and then something really goes off the rails because somebody did something wrong. But then you're almost starting to litigate IQ and ability to do jobs. I mean, look at people, look at families, all these things you take into consideration. Like, well, I mean, look where they came from. Not the best upbringing, not the smartest people. You have the same thing in police departments. You have ones that are great, you have ones that are middle of the road, and ones that are literally like a mental institution. Is that something that should have better defined guardrails on in terms of what is acceptable, what is not, from a legal perspective, in your opinion?
You know, I think that as a general principle, if a person or entity screws up royally, they should be held accountable. And that's going to be a deterrent against them screwing up royally in the future. That's not something we have presently, especially when it comes to law enforcement. Look, in the private sector, if a plaintiff brings a civil case against a defendant, and it's bogus, it's garbage, what happens is that plaintiff could be on the hook to pay the defense's costs and fees. No such thing exists in the public sector. So if a prosecutor brings a completely trash case against a defendant and loses, it's just like, oops, well, so what? There's no accountability mechanism to try to deter that prosecutor's office from doing the same thing. Same with a law enforcement agency that's gross, that's overly negligent. What's going to be the... the spanking that gets them to change things with qualified immunity. There's no spankings allowed. And so I think that some reform does have to take place.
Yeah. And I think one of the greatest challenges of this, as we started talking about, the first thing that popped in my mind is, in the Bureau, you have investigative operational guidelines. And so when you start getting down to the state and local level, the SOP, standard operating procedures for every department, is going to look different because it's not universal. And so if you're going to have a universal law, you have to have a universal code. And then when you start dealing with human beings, those things become very subjective. It's how they hide behind things. And then on top of it, you have the hugest challenge we've had in a bunch last probably 5-10 years, and that is hiring and retention of qualified people to exercise those standard operating procedures, because no one wants to be a cop anymore because of these things. And so that's one of the reasons why it's so challenging, I think, to have a standard operating procedure to hold people accountable for gross negligence, because they're trying to figure out what the hell negligence looks like, because they can't figure it out on a day-to-day basis because there's no guidelines, or the guidelines are so subjective. And also, every case is so unique and different. One homicide here, which might have interstate things that you could bring in the FBI right away on, and then you have the federal guidelines, which are different. I mean, there's so many things and complexities when you're dealing legally, and you got lawyers and prosecutors with limited bandwidth, caseloads like this, local law enforcement is trying to get them on board to see if they're actually going to have the bandwidth to actually prosecute. See what I mean? It's a lot of how you make the sausage explanation about why this is such a big challenge. And it just comes down to, why don't people just stop being asses?
Yes. Yeah. I agree. I mean,
in law enforcement.
That's all it really comes down to at the end of the day. And then you have all the technicalities and all the caveats, and everything just is being argued on technicalities rather than the merits of cases. And that's where we are today. That where everything just kind of ends up settling on. Well, you didn't dot that I, so because of that, we're going to say none of this is valid. And it's like, it's not.
It's Jim Bob's brother. We're going to pay more attention to him. This guy gave more money to police benevolent associations. So we're going to pay more because that's also the challenge. It's not that any of these cases aren't righteous. It's like we see all the time. Well, how come this missing person was covered and this one wasn't? Well, mm-hmm. We've got a lot of factors going that, which gets the attention of media. And then if it's attention of media, it gets attention of politicians, they start poking law enforcement, and then they got to shift their bandwidth. All these things play into the fact that we need people to stop being asses.
Well, I'm glad we've established that. Everybody stop being asses and our problems are solved.
I know. Isn't it though?
It seems so simple, yet
the
it's
anti-nutter pill is what we need.
Yes. And by the way, we'll be like Alex Jones. You too can get the anti-nutter pill. Everybody, I'm selling the anti-nutter pill, and we'll be great. It'll be wonderful. We'll start selling supplements.
Start selling our booklets.
Booklets and supplements.
That's more impressive than I thought.
Holy shit. We're going to make a boatload of money here. I can't wait.
It's our new merch.
Supplements. All right. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. Let's go to another case. Prosecutors just filed the most detailed document that has been produced, and the defense responded by doing the opposite of what everyone expected. After pushing for the fastest possible preliminary hearing, Blair Burke reversed course to ask for a delay in our David case here. The judge denied her motion to seal the filing, set the hearing for May 26, and the public got its first look at what prosecutors say actually happened. Former felony prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis is here with us to help break down what all of this means. The People's Brief is out. It doesn't just include evidence. And I want to get your thoughts on this because there's a lot of information that's being presented right out of the gate. And I'm wondering what that means, because some cases we have like little to no information on what the prosecution is bringing. I'm thinking back to some cases where it's a mountain of evidence against this young lady, and we don't know what the hell the mountain of evidence actually is. This one, they give you a mountain of evidence, a rideshare pickup, a text fight the day day before an alleged stabbing, and then Burke reportedly doing a radio interview and dropping his album within 48 hours. As a former prosecutor, Eric, when you lay out, and there's far more details than that, obviously, when you lay out basically almost the whole case, it seems, and I'm going to assume there's still some more stuff up their sleeve, not at trial, but in the prelim, what is that document really written to do?
You know, in my appraisal, Tony, I think a part of it is that a lot of people had been wondering, like, hey, why hasn't David been arrested? Why has this taken months and months and months? You know, what is the delay? What's going on? This dismembered young woman was found within his vehicle. What's going on? And so I'm wondering if this is the prosecution and law enforcement sort of saying, hey, this is what we're doing. This is why it took so long. We really were getting after it and acquiring some serious evidence against this person. And hey, public, just so you know, like we're on top of it. I think that might be a piece of it. Additionally, I think it's sending a message to defense saying, hey, y'all got some problems. You guys are going to have an uphill battle here and perhaps sort of muscling through some leverage by going in the direction of trying to get maybe some kind of guilty plea at some point by showing a big part of their hand and saying, hey, look, you guys are screwed as it is. You better come to the table.
You know, Eric, one of the defense first said in response to, you know, his being arrested was that he wasn't, what's the language they used again? He wasn't the cause of her death. Meanwhile, all of a sudden, prosecution, you know, laid out all these things. What do you think they're going to do at that point? Do you think they're going to double down on he wasn't involved in her death, or are they going to try to shift that focus based on everything they've been seeing?
Yeah, that's a very astute observation. I made the same observation, Robin, of the defense's statement. What it telegraphs to me is that they think at this juncture, prosecution cannot place the instrument of death in David's hands. There's some evidence that he was proximal to something horrible that happened and perhaps had some involvement, may have purchased some supplies. But can you prove that David was the one who did the stabbing? Can you even prove that it's a stabbing after the body has been disarticulated and, you know, rotting for months and months? I'm not 100% sure about that medical examiner's opinion. And so I think that that's what defense is sort of telegraphing on their side, saying, hey, some horrible stuff went down, but you're not going to be able to depend on this guy, at least in terms of cause of death. And so maybe defense is saying, hey, maybe we come to the table on something lesser, but by telegraphing that signal.
Yeah, you can prove that he bought chainsaws, and since she didn't die by chainsaw, he's actually not the cause of death.
I mean, and I get it. I get the circumstantial argument here. I mean, and it would be something that it's certainly, if you don't have a whole lot of cards to play with and you're the defense, you're going to play what you got. And if that is one of the options, it is one of the options. Not a great option, but it is what it is, because you're kind of rolling the dice. I mean, and at least, and then the prosecution has to roll the dice a little bit too and say, yeah, we may not have that, but no jury in their right mind is going to hear all of this and go, he couldn't possibly have anything to do with it. People convict on circumstantial evidence all of the time. The mythos that it's like somehow not solid evidence is just bullshit. Sometimes it is more powerful than other evidence because it tells a story often. It gives you motive in more cases than not. And in more cases than not, that's what people's brains are looking for. They understand that shit more than they understand DNA processing and all of that that goes with it than the scientific language. So it is, it's an interesting one and an interesting dice that they would have to roll there with. Does the state care if they go to trial or not? Is the interest of the prosecution, of the DA, to get this thing settled? Let me ask you that, because I don't know the answer to this from behind the scenes. As a DA, when you're in that position, when you're the prosecutor, is it to get these things to trial or just try and get as many settled as quickly and reasonably as you can. What is the goal there in that position, Eric?
Totally. So it truly does depend on each case. And what I mean is that, let's say you have case X, where you have a person who allegedly committed something egregious, just nightmarishly horrible, and you have all of the evidence to back it up. You've got the goods. You've got the ammunition. Under those circumstances, we used to call those GORP cases, which is guilty or go to trial, something like that. Yeah. Forget the acronym. But it's essentially, hey, you plead to the top count, or we're taking you to trial. We're getting the maximum conviction out of this and the maximum sentence. There are other cases where you don't have the goods, or where there's mitigating information about the defendant and what they may have done and their background, things like that. In those circumstances, sometimes it's better to, instead of going full bore and saying, hey, let's just take this to trial, even though we might lose, and perhaps securing, you know, a second degree murder conviction is extraordinarily serious, carries decades and decades in prison. Perhaps that is a better route to take in those such cases. So it's a really case-by-case scenario.
Yeah, do you think this might kind of go the way that Koberger went, since, and I'm thinking even more so because the evidence here seems to be a lot more even than the Koberger case, and eventually, again, this is what I learned through doing all this and talking to amazing people like you, defense attorneys, you know, that the primary goal is to keep your client alive, and since death penalty, they haven't sought it yet, but it's actually on the table, do you think that might be defense kind of lining themselves up for a plea agreement or something to save his life more than anything else?
I think that has to be front of mind. You know, even though it is subject to the death penalty is somewhat uncommon in California. But that being said, we've got a horrific alleged case here. And so certainly as defense, you're thinking about, hey, can I preserve this person's life? Can I somehow mitigate their exposure? What is, you know, what could that look like? Is that less prison time? Is that a lesser conviction? Is that vying for a complete acquittal because we think we can get it? You've got to really assess what that exposure looks like and try to minimize it on as many fronts as you can.
There's obviously a lot here in terms of circumstantial evidence. He allegedly ordered that shovel, chainsaws, a body bag, an inflatable pool where parts of the pool were found in her remains, a burn cage under a fake name. I mean, this is just what we have on the surface. We don't even know, like, is there DNA? Is this DNA on anything? I mean, I'm going to guess at some point, maybe. I don't think the odds are probably fairly high that we're going to get there. I mean, how much does that kind of a consciousness of guilt evidence actually carry with a jury, especially against the defense claiming that he didn't cause her death?
You know, you bring up a good point, and you sort of alluded to it earlier, Tony, in terms of circumstantial evidence and how powerful it can be. When I was a prosecutor, one thing I would do in jury selection is I would say, hey, let's say you went to bed at night and there was no snow on the ground, and you woke up in the morning. It wasn't actively snowing, but you see snow all over your yard. What happened? You know, everybody's going to be like, oh, well, obviously it snowed. And I'll say, hey, you didn't personally witness it snowing, did you? You know, you didn't have some meteorologist out there monitoring the snowfall, things like that. And the juror's right. Like, dude, it's fucking common sense. It was snowing.
The ice cream truck exploded. Yeah.
Fucking defense attorneys, right, man.
You know, I think you argue anything. That principle can be really compelling for jurors who are instructed to bring their common sense to the deliberations. And I think when you have chainsaws and burn cages and all of the other forensic evidence and everything else, I think it's going to be pretty compelling to a jury.
And a body in your car.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and the body's in your car, too. Yeah. That too.
That you were last seen going in and out of. Oh my God. So Eric, also, I'm also curious. I'm keep going back to this statement. The not the cause of death, right? Do you think that's because, again, I'm channeling my inner Eric and my inner Bob Mata on this one of what you're doing with your client? Do you think that's they came out with that statement prior to really knowing what went on, or that David wasn't being as transparent as he should have been with counsel, or was it because they listened to him, he's being factual what he thought they'd see, and they thought this was the best course of action? Or do you think it was a boo-boo?
I think that they wouldn't have made the statement unless they had a reasonable belief that 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 position would play out if it went to trial. So I think they've got something. And, you know, it reminds me a little bit, Robin, of the Robert Durst case, the Jinx, in the sense that in that case, he was accused of killing his neighbor in Texas and then dismembering and disposing of the body. And he pretty much copped to the latter allegations. But he said, hey, wait a sec, though. I didn't kill this person unlawfully. It was self-defense in that case. But perhaps they're teeing it up for something like, hey, all of this horrible evidence, that's evidence of accessory after the fact. That's evidence of destruction of evidence and concealment. But that's a far cry from being guilty of homicide.
In reality, you're right. It could be the most genius play they had.
But wait, there's more. You know, it's like they inch their way up the steps like, oh, okay, like, oh, maybe we can go there. Oh, and then there's child CSAM material.
Yeah, unless there's photos on the cell phone of him doing it, too.
And there's that. Well, there's pictures of her on his cell phone. She's a child, and she's not, and it's CSAM material.
Because those are the other charge. I know, because we've been focusing on the murder aspect. We actually haven't even gone on to that aspect, the exploitation of underage children.
Yeah, so you get all that on there as well. That's just more sprinkles on the hellish, Sunday here.
Can you believe that's the lighter side of this?
I know. I mean, and it's not really the lighter side. I mean, there's no light side to this. Right. It's all just shit. But so you get that on top of it. Is there any world in which the David doesn't face the death penalty here other than pleading? I mean, is that really the only way out at this point? I don't see. I mean, in my opinion, I don't see them not keeping death on the table for this guy, unless it's we'll take it off and you plead and you're going to prison forever.
But innocent until proven guilty.
Yes. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah. What comes to mind is the death penalty can be extraordinarily hard to secure, especially in California. Look, right. I'm in Colorado, and we have the Aurora Theater shooter, James Holmes, and he killed 10 plus people. And still, the jury in Colorado, which is not as liberal or however you want to put it as California, did not impose the death penalty. So that's what the prosecutor's got to think about. If I go for the death penalty and I lose, that's a black eye on the prosecution, and that's a ton of money wasted, especially if defendant would have been willing to do a plea. So I still think that there's some room for negotiations on all of those issues, but a lot of leverage the prosecution has with the threat alone of the death penalty.
Yeah, and that's a great question, Eric. And I know California is not your place, but I'm wondering, do you have any sense of what kind of circumstances in California would raise it to the fact that they would seek a death penalty? And I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but I'm just kind of curious what it would take to do that, because this seems pretty horrendous. I haven't had a chance to do research to see how horrendous in California standards it is, but it seems pretty bad.
There's a lot of commonality in terms of death penalty factors across the United States. So some of those factors are if it was especially heinous and cruel. For example, if there was some torture involved, it was an elongated death. Also, killing a child, that's almost always a potential aggravating factor that can justify the death penalty. Celeste here was, I think, either 13 or 14 when they're claiming she was killed. On top of that, doing things for financial gain, which Hoffman sort of signaled that, and in fact added that to the complaint, that he did this for his own financial gain, that can be a death penalty factor. So certainly those factors are present for bringing that highest potential penalty.
Yeah, so one of those cases, if not this, then who, right?
Does anybody give him any grace for his age, for being young? I mean, he's an adult. But, I don't know. And I don't know the answer to that. I personally don't give him any. He's an idiot. I think he'd be an evil idiot no matter what age. Maybe more evil calculated. Maybe more, maybe more cautious if he got away with this. But does that factor play into here? He's not a minor. He wasn't a minor when these things happened, but he's just over the line, really.
Yeah, if we were talking about a shoplifting case, a DA might look at that and say, oh, this guy is 21, 22. That's different than if the guy was 40. The person's probably more morally culpable at 40 than 21. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about such a allegedly heinous act that also involved, perpetrating sexually upon a child and all of these other factors. I think the DA is saying, I don't care if this dude was a day over 18. Yeah. We're going at him full bore.
Yeah, this isn't a whoopsie.
No,
not even close.
No, too much.
Because look at it. I think part of it, too, and correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, the time span involved here. This wasn't just a situation, a relationship that existed for like a day, a month, or a couple years. Months. This was years of grooming, years of abuse, years of doing horrendous things and taking advantage of this little girl. So, yeah, I think that's part of it.
Yeah, I think there's, I don't know what they use. It might be a nice chair or a nice firing squad or a nice needle waiting at the end of the rainbow here for David. Maybe he can write a song about it on his way out. Wouldn't that be special? Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack or YouTube. The links are in the description. Let's go to another fine human being. Brian Koberger confessed, waived appeal. He's done. But a new book and a fired up defense expert are trying to sell doubt about a closed case and his own former defense team just went public to tear the expert apart. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with myself and Robin Drake to help break down who's credible, who's not, and whether any of this actually matters. Me and Robin tried to do the book over last week. And honestly, I got like 2 hours. How far did you get? I got 2 hours in before I said I'm done.
About two or three. And actually, it's the first Audible book I actually ever returned in my life.
I didn't know you could return Audible books until you told me that.
But luckily I did it because you can only do it if you use a credit to get it. And that's what I got. I got my credit back. And first time I ever did it, I just couldn't stomach it. And it just... It was just way off.
I did too. It was like, this is bullshit. But anyway, that's our opinion. But let's talk about because there is some, there's some smoke coming here out of it. And I think it's important to address it so it just doesn't, continue to spread and turn into a wildfire. Brent Turvey signed a confidentiality agreement when he was hired by Koberger's defense. He's now talking to reporters and collaborated on the book and has been making claims allegedly about evidence he reviewed under that agreement. Ann Taylor's team has said that he was never released from the confidentiality agreement. Turvey says everything he shared was already public. So I'm coming to you, legal man, as a former prosecutor. Does a defense expert get to decide on his own when his confidentiality agreement no longer applies in a case that's already closed?
The short answer is no. The answer is that the confidentiality agreement and the terms of that agreement would govern whether this expert could disclose information, what information can be disclosed, and under what circumstances. But there's other legal provisions that might be applicable. If the expert thought that the defense attorney committed some kind of violation of law or ethical duty in their representation. You can't have an NDA that prevents disclosure of a crime. So you probably can't have an NDA that prevents disclosure of unethical activity on behalf of a professional who's governed by an ethics board. I think he has an argument that the expert has an argument that, one, all this is publicly available anyway, so what's the harm? What sort of harm is there from disclosing this? Two, I was simply disclosing things that I thought were unlawful under legal and ethical standards. And I think a judge might look at that and say, we can't shut a guy up because they're trying to be a whistleblower. I think that's how the expert might frame it.
So here's my question I've been waiting to ask you, Eric, since I started trying to read this book. It was tough for me to read based on the premise, and I'm curious about whether my understanding of this is correct or not, because it's legal based, and I'm just a simple human behavior type guy. So the premise that the author used for writing the book was that it's not because he said he agreed that Koberger was guilty, but once he saw these 59,000 documents that was given to him under shady circumstances because of the non-disclosure the guy signed and all whatever's, But he said he felt morally compelled to shed the light on these documents that didn't have their day to be flushed out in court, that there's inaccuracies that and there's with chain of custody. In other words, he's laid out all these things. But as I understand it, that motive is off. It's wrong. And here's why. And that's what I'm curious about your thought on, of whether it's right or not. It didn't get its day in court to be flushed out because Ann Taylor and her team, in conjunction obviously with Koberger, decided it's in their best interest, again, going back to our previous conversation, number one objective, preserve his life from the death penalty. And as a team, based on what they had, the raw information without being flushed out in court, said to them they couldn't win this case, and they're deciding to make the call to plead to save his life. So his argument that these things are inaccurate here, it doesn't matter because they probably would have been if they had their day in court, but they made the decision not to give it this day in court because they saw it as unwinnable. Is that accurate?
That's kind of how I see it, Robin. Look, experts disagree all the time. Prosecution and defense experts, civil plaintiff and civil defense experts disagree about demonstrable facts, about objective things, about things that are on video and stuff like that. So the fact that this expert, thought there may have been some inaccuracies, some chain of custody issues, that is going to be one small piece of a defense counsel's analysis, especially in a death penalty case. And if defense, concludes, hey, we could make a big rah-rah deal about this thing, but it's minor. There's all this substantial evidence against the dude anyway. And if we go the route of making a big deal about it at trial, we risk this guy getting killed. Whereas if we take a plea, it preserves the guy's life. And that risk of him being killed is so high based on the other evidence that it's not worth it. And I imagine that's how Ann Taylor analyzed it.
Thanks. And when you look at the credibility of Ann Taylor and her years and experience, and as nervous as we were here, because, innocent to proven guilty, but we're all rooting for the fact that she wasn't going to win these appeals. I mean, she was pounding that stone hard, we thought, and doing a really good job of it. And to have her second guest on that when it wasn't even had its day in court, it was just interesting. That's why I had a hard time reading his conjecture, the author's conjecture, because it was him, the guy who gave it to him, and one unnamed other agent. No experience, no reps in this area, no legal reps, and that was pure conjecture on that point. So that was why I had a hard time with it. I was just curious about your thoughts on whether that's the right thought I had. Thank you.
I think getting a lot of people about this book is the interpretation of the situation of the evidence, and the interpretation that the book seems to make, and some the author, I believe, and the some of the experts here, in the way I've read it, in my opinion, is that the evidence, the DNA evidence specifically, the knife sheath, that the chain of custody, they're saying it was broken, and they're backing that up by saying because the sheet that was on the evidence bag itself, it was all written in the same pen by the same person, signing different names at different times, but it looks like it was all done at once. Okay, on the surface, that looks rather weird. Like, that seems somewhat questionable. And then you take 2 seconds and you ask the question of the police, and they're like, oh, well, we do it digitally. That's just supplemental. It's just kind of there. It's like, it could be there. It doesn't have to be there, but we have a much better system. We scan it, and it's digital down to the second that it was scanned in. We know exactly who did it. It's much more reliable. It's like somebody saying that I'd rather pay with a check because it's more secure, even though your banking information is all there. But somehow they believe it's more accurate because it's on a piece of paper. When reality, that credit card's going to be a hell of a lot more secure and safer and accurate. It's a perception thing, and the perception is inherently wrong. Everybody can come to their own conclusion, but when it's inherently wrong, and then it's backed up, and then it's published, and the other side of the equation is not present when someone's consuming the information, you have thousands of people who consume that and go, oh my God, look at this. And it's really nothing. And most people never take the time to fully inform themselves on what the reality is. They're just going to go with that because it fits the narrative that seems more comfortable to them. There's really nothing inherently illegal about that. Ethically, it's irresponsible. Morally, it's irresponsible. But beyond that, I mean, Taylor bringing up, you know, hey, you're speaking out of turn here with your NDA and releasing a statement about it. But beyond that, just making reckless statements, I guess, is there any recourse for that for anybody who might want to take it, whether it be Ann Taylor, whether it be the families of the victims who inevitably will be harassed more by the pro-burger morons out there on this planet that unfortunately still share our atmosphere. I'm wondering, you know, is there anything for that type of reckless reporting, in my opinion?
I don't think there is, in part, Tony, because I think the expert's going to say, hey, this was my opinion. This is, you know, I looked at this and this is how I felt. This is my belief. It's different than a statement of fact for which a defamation claim can be brought. And, you know, just think about how this would play out at trial. I think Ann Taylor was totally right to make the decision she did, because the bar to admitting the sheath is authenticity, among some other standards, which is it what it purports to be? Does it, are you saying that the sheath that was found there? And if there is some little report, this is, oh, look, see, this report looks weird, doesn't it? The prosecutor is going to say, oh, well, there's a digital explanation for this. And on top of that, we've done extensive DNA testing. And on top of that, we have the vehicle evidence. We have the cell phone evidence. We have everything else. Mm-hmm. And so shut the fuck up. I think a jury is going to be like, oh, this stupid little chain of custody document that was handwritten is trivial.
Mm-hmm. It's a shut the fuck up response, right?
I mean, and that's the reality of it. I mean, just saying something offensive or irresponsible is not necessarily illegal. I mean, he could write a book saying that he's convinced or that he believes Brian Koberger thought the victims were aliens and his dog was telling him to do it.
Exactly what I was thinking.
And the author maybe slightly believes that, you know, golden doodles speak to him when he goes to Petco. I mean, I'm just throwing random crazy shit out there, but you could publish that. And it's up to the other people in the world to either go, this is insane, or take it in and go, see?
Finally, someone's speaking my truth.
I guess that's the problem of the world that we live in today. The craziness used to die with craziness because there wasn't ways to continue to perpetuate it. Now we have communities for crazy, and the communities for crazy perpetuate crazy and then spread it to other people who are just unhinged enough to believe it. And then it just spreads further, and it ends up spreading back to the actual living victims here in a case like that. I think that's why it's so upsetting to so many, because it ends up re-victimizing people who've already gone through hell.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think that that's part of the discomfort and frustration with a free speech society. And I think that we just have to tolerate a good amount of bullshit because clamping down on it would result in a potential chilling effect on free speech. You know, people are allowed to say stuff, even if it's offensive, even if it's insulting, even if it's not true in some circumstances. So, yeah, I think it's just kind of a function of our setup.
And besides, there's nothing more in life I love than debunking nutters, man. I love debunking conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, I agree. I don't even know what to make of this. It feels like this, in my opinion, here's my opinion. It feels like, I don't know if I want to call it a cash grab or what, but
looks that way.
The fact that they couldn't even pronounce the Gonzalez name correctly in the audiobook, I think tells you all you need to know about how legit the damn book is.
You know, I mean, we hit this the other day too, Tony. It is so, because you've narrated your own books. I've narrated all my books. And for this to be with a mainline publisher, the fact that the director didn't correct the name pronunciation, I mean, it's just one data point, but the data point says to me, rush to publish.
Yeah.
And so when you're in a rush, you know, you're not vetting what you should be vetting. I think.
I mean, it's like nobody checking work anymore. I mean, we see it in major publications all the time. Errors that used to only occur in like small town shitty newspapers with no staff. Now it's like on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, everything. And there's just errors everywhere because people aren't crossing their T's or dotting their I's. It just strikes me as shocking that nobody is taking that time to do it. But when it's like, let's get it out, let's get our money, I don't know. I guess you'd think publishing a book would be a little bit more than just going live on a podcast.
It was just so evident of the lack of paying attention to the case. You know, there's thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people, if not even more, that have really paid a lot of close attention to this case. I remember I still had a hard time pronouncing their name, you know, the Gonzaleses, because it's a hard name to say. But when you listen enough, when you pay attention enough, you pick it up and you get it. And for the author who narrated his own book to because again, the optic that was presented, again, just an opinion as we caveat, is that didn't even know the case well enough. First foray into true crime, and it was a deep dive or an attempt to do a deep dive on a case that was so extensively covered and so in the public eye that to make such a blatant error, and not only on his part, okay, but on the part of the director, the publisher, you're like, damn, that is just like one, it's not just a little data point. To me, it was like a huge chunk of what's going on here.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, here's the raw studio session, let's get some outtakes. This is the album. This is the published work.
And Tony didn't even do pickups. And so after you record a book, here's what goes on. You go to a studio, you narrate your book, and then what happens is when it goes to the publisher and it goes through editing, if they pick up on something that was missaid, misspoken, you do a thing called a pickup. You're either called back into a studio or you do it from your home, and you'll go through. I mean, it took me on Unbreakable Alliances, I think I did probably about another 45 minutes worth of pickups after I was directed to correct errors of speech, intonation, pronunciations. This wasn't even picked up after that. So that was kind of weird, man.
Yeah. It leaves a lot to be desired. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books. Go and check it out. And also be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, as always, thank you so much for joining us and giving us your valuable insight as you always do every Thursday here on the program.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Your thoughts in the comment section. We will continue our conversation there. Until next time, for Eric, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
A noisy garage door is a cry for help. Hi, I'm Tommy Mello, owner of Don's Garage Door Service. Most repairs are simple, but if left untreated, they can turn into costly repairs. Your garage door works hard every day, and a little maintenance goes a long way. We fix garage doors fast with quality parts designed to last a lifetime. Over 90,000 five-star reviews don't happen by accident. They happen by putting people first. Fixing your garage doors is what we do. From repairs to upgrades, call Don's Garage Door Service today.
Chumba. Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
A noisy garage door is a cry for help. Hi, I'm Tommy Mello, owner of Don's Garage Door Service. Most repairs are simple, but if left untreated, they can turn into costly repairs. Your garage door works hard every day, and a little maintenance goes a long way. We fix garage doors fast with quality parts designed to last a lifetime. Over 90,000 five-star reviews don't happen by accident. They happen by putting people first. Fixing your garage doors is what we do. From repairs to upgrades, call Don's Garage Door Service today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I started my first business when I was 12, mowing lawns for about $5 a yard. I learned if you do the job right, people trust you and customers care that you show up and do what you say you're going to do. Hi, I'm Tommy Mello, owner of Don's Garage Doors. From garage door repairs to upgrades, we show up, we stand behind every job. We only use the best parts and springs guaranteed to last a lifetime. When you care about the people you serve, you work harder and it shows. Call Don's Garage Doors today or schedule online at donsgaragedoors.com.
When it comes to garage doors, no one knows more.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
A noisy garage door is a cry for help. Hi, I'm Tommy Mello, owner of Don's Garage Door Service. Most repairs are simple, but if left untreated, they can turn into costly repairs. Your garage door works hard every day, and a little maintenance goes a long way. We fix garage doors fast with quality parts designed to last a lifetime. Over 90,000 five-star reviews don't happen by accident. They happen by putting people first. Fixing your garage doors is what we do. From repairs to upgrades, call Don's Garage Door Service today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
A noisy garage door is a cry for help. Hi, I'm Tommy Mello, owner of Don's Garage Door Service. Most repairs are simple, but if left untreated, they can turn into costly repairs. Your garage door works hard every day, and a little maintenance goes a long way. We fix garage doors fast with quality parts designed to last a lifetime. Over 90,000 five-star reviews don't happen by accident. They happen by putting people first. Fixing your garage doors is what we do. From repairs to upgrades, call Don's Garage Door Service today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
A noisy garage door is a cry for help. Hi, I'm Tommy Mello, owner of Don's Garage Door Service. Most repairs are simple, but if left untreated, they can turn into costly repairs. Your garage door works hard every day, and a little maintenance goes a long way. We fix garage doors fast with quality parts designed to last a lifetime. Over 90,000 five-star reviews don't happen by accident. They happen by putting people first. Fixing your garage doors is what we do. From repairs to upgrades, call Don's Garage Door Service today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
If you want something done right, you do it yourself. That's why you change your own oil. You wouldn't trust your engine to just anybody. So go with the full synthetic motor oil you can trust. Pennzoil Ultra Platinum offers engine protection for the lifetime of your vehicle. So do it right with Pennzoil Ultra Platinum. Stock up now at Walmart. Pennzoil. Long may we drive. Limited lubrication warranty for lifetime engine protection. Other conditions apply, including enrollment and receipt requirements. See Pennzoil.com/warranty for full details and terms.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once-daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.